playing King of the Mountain, he could see that Leslie was surrounded by a group of girls led by Wanda Kay. He couldn't hear what they were saying, but he could tell by the proud way Leslie was throwing her head back that the others were making fun of her. Greg Williams grabbed him then, and while they wrestled, Leslie disappeared. It was none of his business, really, but he threw Greg down the hill as hard as he could and yelled to no one in particular, "Gotta go!" He stationed himself across from the girls' room. Leslie came out in a few minutes. He could tell she had been crying. "Hey, Leslie," he called softly.
"Go away."
She turned abruptly and headed the other way in a fast walk. With an eye on the office door, he ran after her. Nobody was supposed to be in the halls during recess. "Leslie, what's the matter?"
"You know perfectly well what's the matter, Jess Ahrens."
"Yeah," he rubbed his hair. "If you'd have just kept her mouth shut. You can always watch it, my..." But she had wheeled around again and was zooming down the hall. Before he could finish the sentence and catch up with her, she was swinging the door to the girl's room right at his nose. Jess slunk out of the building. He couldn't risk Mr. Turner catching him hanging around the girls' room as though he was some kind of pervert or something. After school, Leslie got on the bus before he did and went straight to the corner on the long back seat, right to the seventh grader's seat. He jerked his head at her to warn her to come farther up front, but she wouldn't even look at him. He could see the seventh graders headed for the bus, the huge, bossy, bosomy girls and the mean, skinny, narrow-eyed boys. They'd kill her for sitting in their territory. He jumped up and ran to the back and grabbed Leslie by the arm. "You gotta come up to your regular seat, Leslie." Even as he spoke, he could feel the bigger kids pushing up behind him down the narrow aisle. Indeed, Janice Avery, who among all the seventh graders was the one person who devoted her entire life to scaring the wits out of anyone smaller than she, was right behind him. "Move, kid," she said. He planted his body as firmly as he could, although his heart was knocking at his Adam's apple. "Come on, Leslie," he said, and then he made himself turn and give Janice Avery one of those lookovers from frizz blonde hair past too tight blouse and broad-beamed jeans to gigantic sneakers. When he finished, he swallowed, stared straight up at her scowling face, and said almost steadily, "Don't look like there'll be room across the back here for you and Janice Avery." Somebody hooted, "Weight Watchers is waiting for you, Janice." Janice's eyes were hate mad, but she moved aside for Jess and Leslie to make their way past her to their regular seat. Leslie glanced back as they sat down and then leaned over. "She's going to get you for that, Jess. Boy, she is mad." Jess warmed to the tone of respect in Leslie's voice, but he didn't dare look back. "Heck," he said, "you think I'm going to let some dumb cow like that scare me?" By the time they got off the bus, he could finally send a swallow past his Adam's apple without choking. He even gave a little wave at the back seat as the bus pulled off. Leslie was grinning at him over Maybelle's head. "Well," he said happily, "see you." "Hey, do you think we could do something this afternoon?"
"Me too. I want to do something too,"
Maybelle shrilled. Jess looked at Leslie. No was in her eyes.
"Not this time, Maybelle. Leslie and I got something we got to do just by ourselves today. You can carry my books home and tell Mom I'm over at Burke's, okay?" "You ain't got nothing to do. You ain't even planned nothing."
Leslie came and leaned over Maybelle, putting her hand on the little girl's thin shoulder. "Maybelle, would you like some new paper dolls?" Maybelle slid her eyes around suspiciously.
"What kind?"
"Life in colonial America." Maybelle shook her head.
"I want Bride or Miss America."
"You can pretend these are Bride paper dolls. They have lots of beautiful long dresses."
"What's the matter with them?"
"Nothing. They're brand new."
"How come you don't want them if they're so great?"
"When you're my age," Leslie gave a little sigh, "you just don't play with paper dolls anymore. My grandmother sent me these. You know how it is. Grandmothers just forget you're growing up." Maybelle's one living grandmother was in Georgia and never sent her anything.
"You already punched them out?"
"No, honestly. And all the clothes punch out, too. You don't have to use scissors." They could see she was weakening. "How about," Jess began, "you coming down and taking a look at them, and if they suit you, you can take them along home when you go tell Mama where I am."
After they had watched Maybelle tearing up the hill, clutching her new treasure, Jess and Leslie turned and ran up over the empty field behind the old Perkins place and down to the dry creek bed that separated farmland from the woods. There was an old crabapple tree there, just at the bank of the creek bed, from which someone, long forgotten, had hung a rope. They took turns swinging across the gully on the rope. It was a glorious autumn day, and if you looked up as you swung, it gave you the feeling of floating. Jess leaned back and drank in the rich, clear color of the sky. He was drifting, drifting like a fat, white, lazy cloud back and forth across the blue. "Do you know what we need?" Leslie called to him. Intoxicated as he was with the heavens, he couldn't imagine needing anything on earth. "We need a place," she said, "just for us. It would be so secret that we would never tell anyone in the whole world about it." Jess came swinging back and dragged his feet to stop. She lowered her voice almost to a whisper. "It might be a whole secret country," she continued, "and you and I would be the rulers of it." Her words stirred inside of him. He'd like to be a ruler of something, even something that wasn't real. "Okay," he said. "Where could we have it?" "Over there in the woods, where nobody would come and mess it up." There were parts of the woods that Jess did not like, dark places where it was almost like being underwater, but he didn't say so. "I know," she was getting excited. "It could be a magic country, like Narnia, and the only way you can get in is by swinging across on this enchanted rope." Her eyes were bright. She grabbed the rope. "Come on," she said. "Let's find a place to build our castle stronghold." They had only gone a few yards into the woods beyond the creek bed when Leslie stopped. "How about right here?" she asked. "Sure," Jess agreed quickly, relieved that there was no need to plunge deeper into the woods. He would take her there, of course, for he wasn't such a coward that he would mind a little exploring now and then farther in amongst the ever-darkening columns of the tall pines. But as a regular thing, as a permanent place, this was where he would choose to be. Here, where the dogwood and redbud played hide-and-seek between the oaks and evergreens, and the sun flung itself in golden streams through the trees to splash warmly at their feet. "Sure," he repeated himself, nodding vigorously. The underbrush was dry and would be easy to clear away. The ground was almost level. "This will be a good place to build." Leslie named their secret land Terabithia, and she loaned Jess all of her books about Narnia so he would know how things went in a magic kingdom, how the animals and the trees must be protected, and how a ruler must behave. That was the hard part. When Leslie spoke, the words rolling out so regally, you knew she was a proper queen. He could hardly manage English, much less the poetic language of a king. But he could make stuff. They dragged boards and other materials down from the scrap heap by Miss Bessie's pasture and built their castle stronghold in the place they had found in the woods. Leslie filled a 3-pound coffee can with crackers and dried fruit and a 1-pound can with strings and nails. They found 5 old Pepsi bottles, which they washed and filled with water, in case, as Leslie said, of siege. Like God in the Bible, they looked at what they had made and found it very good. "You should draw a picture of Terabithia for us to hang in the castle," Leslie said. "I can't." How could he explain it in a way Leslie would understand? How he yearned to reach out and capture the quivering life about him, and how when he tried, it slipped past his fingertips, leaving a dry fossil upon the page. "I just can't get the poetry of the trees," he said. She nodded. "Don't worry," she said. "You will someday." He believed her, because there in the shadowy light of the stronghold, everything seemed possible. Between the two of them, they owned the world, and no enemy, Gary Fulcher, Wanda K. Moore, Janice Avery, Jess's own fears and insufficiencies, nor any of the foes whom Leslie imagined attacking Terabithia could ever really defeat them. A few days after they finished the castle, Janice Avery fell down in the school bus and yelled that Jess had tripped her as she went past. She made such a fuss that Mrs. Prentice, the driver, ordered Jess off the bus and he had to walk the 3 miles home. When Jess finally got to Terabithia, Leslie was huddled next to one of the cracks below the roof trying to get enough light to read. There was a picture on the cover which showed a killer whale attacking a dolphin. "What you doing?" He came in and sat beside her on the ground. Reading. I had to do something. That girl! Her anger came rocketing to the surface. It don't matter. I don't mind walking all that much. What was a little hike compared to what Janice Avery might have chosen to do? It's the principle of the thing, Jess. That's what you've got to understand. You have to stop people like that. Otherwise, they turn into tyrants and dictators. He reached over and took the whale book from her hands, pretending to study the bloody picture on the jacket. Getting any good ideas? What? I thought you was getting some ideas on how to stop Janice Avery. No, stupid. We're trying to save the whales. They might become extinct. He gave her back the book. You save the whales and shoot the people, huh? She grinned finally. Something like that, I guess. Say, did you ever hear the story about Moby Dick? Who's that? Well, there was once this huge white whale named Moby Dick. And Leslie began to spin out a wonderful story about a whale and a crazy sea captain who was bent on killing it. His fingers itched to try to draw it on paper. Maybe if he had some proper paints, he could do it. There ought to be a way of making the whale shimmering white against the dark water. At first, they avoided each other during school hours, but by October, they grew careless about their friendship. Gary Fulcher, like Brenda, took great pleasure in teasing Jess about his girlfriend. It hardly bothered Jess. He knew that a girlfriend was somebody who chased you on the playground and tried to grab you and kiss you. He could no more imagine Leslie chasing a boy than he could imagine Mrs. Double-Chinned Myers shinnying up the flagpole. Gary Fulcher could go to you-know-where and warm his toes. There was really no free time at school except recess, and now that there were no races, Jess and Leslie usually looked for a quiet place on the field and sat and talked. Except for the magic half-hour on Fridays, recess was all that Jess looked forward to at school. Leslie could always come up with something funny that made the long days bearable. Often the joke was on Mrs. Myers. Leslie was one of those people who sat quietly at her desk, never whispering or daydreaming or chewing gum, doing beautiful schoolwork, and yet her brain was so full of mischief that if the teacher could have once seen through that mask of perfection, she would have thrown her out in horror. Jess could hardly keep a straight face in class, just trying to imagine what might be going on behind that angelic look of Leslie's. One whole morning, as Leslie had related it at recess, she had spent imagining Mrs. Myers on one of those fat farms down in Arizona. In her fantasy, Mrs. Myers was one of the foodaholics who would hide bits of candy bars in odd places, up the hot water faucet, only to be found out and publicly humiliated before all the other fat ladies. That afternoon, Jess kept having visions of Mrs. Myers dressed only in a pink corset being weighed in. "You've been cheating again, Gussie," the tall, skinny directress was saying. Mrs. Myers was on the verge of tears. "Jesse Ahrens?" The teacher's sharp voice punctured his daydream. He couldn't look at Mrs. Myers straight in her pudgy face. He'd crack up. He set his sight on her uneven hemline. "Yes'm?" He was going to have to get coaching from Leslie. Mrs. Myers always caught him when his mind was on vacation, but she never seemed to suspect Leslie of not paying attention. He sneaked a glance up that way. Leslie was totally absorbed in her geography book, or so it would appear to anyone who didn't know. Terabithia was cold in November. They didn't dare build a fire in the castle, though sometimes they would build one outside and huddle around it. For a while, Leslie had been able to keep two sleeping bags in the stronghold, but around the 1st of December, her father noticed their absence, and she had to take them back. Actually, Jess made her take them back. It was not that he was afraid of the Burks, exactly. Leslie's parents were young, with straight white teeth and lots of hair, both of them. Leslie called them Judy and Bill, which bothered Jess more than he wanted it to. It was none of his business what Leslie called her parents, but he just couldn't get used to it. Both of the Burks were writers. Mrs. Burke wrote novels and, according to Leslie, was more famous than Mr. Burke, who wrote about politics. It was really something to see the shelf that had their books on it. Mrs. Burke was Judith Hancock on the cover, which threw you at first, but then if you looked on the back, there was her picture, looking very young and serious. Mr. Burke was going back and forth to Washington to finish a book he was working on with someone else. but he had promised Leslie that after Christmas he would stay home and fix up the house and plant his garden and listen to music and read books out loud and write only in his spare time. They didn't look like Jess's idea of rich, but even he could tell that the jeans they wore had not come off the counter at Newbury's. There was no TV at the Burks, but there were mountains of records and a stereo set that looked like something off Star Trek. And although their car was small and dusty, it was Italian and looked expensive, too. They were always nice to Jess when he went over, but then they would suddenly begin talking about French politics or string quartets, which he at first thought was a square box made out of string, or how to save the timber wolves or redwoods or singing whales, and he was scared to open his mouth and show once and for all how dumb he was. He wasn't comfortable having Leslie at his house, either. Joyce Ann would stare, her index finger pulling down her mouth and making her drool. Brenda and Ellie always managed some remark about girlfriend. His mother acted stiff and funny, just the way she did when she had to go up to school about something. Later, she would refer to Leslie's tacky clothes. Leslie always wore pants, even to school. Her hair was shorter than a boy's. Her parents were hardly more than hippies. May Bell either tried to push in with him and Leslie or sulked at being left out. His father had seen Leslie only a few times and had nodded to show that he had noticed her, but his mother said that she was sure he was fretting that his only son did nothing but play with girls, and they both were worried about what would become of it. Jess didn't concern himself with what would become of it. For the first time in his life, he got up every morning with something to look forward to. Leslie was more than his friend. She was his other, more exciting self, his way to Terabithia and all the worlds beyond. Terabithia was their secret, which was a good thing, for how could Jess have ever explained it to an outsider? Just walking down the hill toward the woods made something warm and liquid steal through his body. The closer he came to the dry creek bed and the crab-apple tree rope, the more he could feel the beating of his heart. He grabbed the end of the rope and swung out toward the other bank with a kind of wild exhilaration and landed gently on his feet, taller and stronger and wiser, in that mysterious land. Leslie's favorite place, besides the castle stronghold, was the pine forest. There the trees grew so thick at the top that the sunshine was veiled. No low bush or grass could grow in that dim light, so the ground was carpeted with golden needles. "I used to think this place was haunted," Jess had confessed to Leslie the first afternoon he had revved up his courage to bring her there. "Oh, but it is," she said. "But you don't have to be scared. It's not haunted with evil things." "How do you know?" "You can just feel it. Listen." At first he heard only the stillness. It was the stillness that had always frightened him before, but this time it was like the moment after Miss Edmonds finished a song, just after the chords hummed down to silence. Leslie was right. They stood there, not moving, not wanting the swish of dry needles beneath their feet to break the spell. Far away from their former world came the cry of geese heading southward. Leslie took a deep breath. "This is not an ordinary place," she whispered. "Even the rulers of Terabithia come into it only at times of greatest sorrow or of greatest joy. We must strive to keep it sacred. It would not do to disturb the spirits." He nodded, and without speaking, they went back to the creek bank where they shared together a solemn meal of crackers and dried fruit. Chapter 5. The Giant Killers. Leslie liked to make up stories about the giants that threatened the peace of Terabithia, but they both knew that the real giant in their lives was Janice Avery. Of course, it wasn't only Jess and Leslie that she was after. She had two friends, Wilma Dean and Bobby Sue Henshaw, who were almost as big as she was, and the three of them would roam the playground, grabbing up hopscotch rocks, running through jump ropes, and laughing while second graders screamed. They would even stand outside the girls' room first thing every morning and make the little girls give them their milk money before they'd let them go to the bathroom. May Bell, unfortunately, was a slow learner. Her daddy had brought her a package of Twinkies, and she was so proud that as soon as she got on the bus, she forgot everything she knew and yelled to another first grader, "Guess what I got in my lunch today, Billie Jean?" "What?" "Twinkies!" she shouted so loud you could have heard her in the back seat even if you were deaf in both ears.
Out of the corner of his eye, Jess thought he saw Janice Avery perk up. When they sat down, Maybelle was still screeching about her dadgum Twinkies over the roar of the motor. "My daddy brung 'em to me from Washington!" Jess threw another look at the back seat. "You better shut up about those dang Twinkies," he said in her ear. "You just jealous 'cause daddy didn't bring you none." "Okay." He shrugged across her head at Leslie to say, "I warned her, didn't I?" And Leslie nodded back. Neither of them was too surprised to see Maybelle come screaming toward them at recess time. "She stole my Twinkies!" Jess sighed. "Maybelle, didn't I tell you? You gotta kill Janice Avery! Kill her! Kill her! Kill her!" "Shh," Leslie said, stroking Maybelle's head. But Maybelle didn't want comfort. She wanted revenge. "You gotta beat her up into a million pieces." He'd sooner tangle with Mrs. Godzilla herself. "Fighting ain't gonna get back nothing, Maybelle. Them Twinkies is well on the way to padding Janice Avery's bottom by now." Leslie snickered, but Maybelle was not to be distracted. "You're just yeller, Jesse Ahrens. If you wasn't yeller, you'd beat somebody up if they took your little sister's Twinkies." She broke into a fresh round of sobbing. Jess stiffened. He avoided Leslie's eyes. Lord, there was no escape. He'd have to fight the female gorilla now. "Look, Maybelle," Leslie was saying, "if Jess picks a fight with Janice Avery, you know perfectly well what will happen." Maybelle wiped her nose on the back of her hand. "She'll beat him up." "No, he'll get kicked out of school for fighting a girl. You know how Mr. Turner is about boys who pick on girls." "She stole my Twinkies." "I know she did, Maybelle, and Jess and I are going to figure out a way to pay her back for it, aren't we, Jess?" He nodded vigorously. Anything was better than promising to fight Janice Avery.
"What's she going to do?"
"I don't know yet. We'll have to plan it out very carefully, but I promise you, Maybelle, we'll get her."
"Cross your heart and hope to die?"
Leslie solemnly crossed her heart. Maybelle turned expectantly to Jess, so he crossed his, too, trying hard not to feel like a fool, crossing his heart to a first grader in the middle of the playground. Maybelle snuffled loudly.
"It ain't as good as seeing her beat to a million pieces."
"No," said Leslie, "I'm sure it isn't. But with Mr. Turner running this school, it's the best we can do. Right, Jess?"
"Right."
That afternoon, crouched in the stronghold of Terabithia, they held a council of war. How to get Janice Avery without ending up squashed or suspended, that was their problem. "Maybe we could get her caught doing something." Leslie was trying out another idea after they had both rejected putting honey on her bus seat and glue in her hand lotion. "You know she smokes in the girls' room. If we could just get Mr. Turner to walk past while the smoke is pouring out." Jess shook his head hopelessly. "It wouldn't take her 5 minutes to find out who squawked." There was a moment of silence while they both considered what Janice Avery might do to anyone who reported her to the principal. "We gotta get her without her knowing who done it." "Yeah," Leslie chewed away at a dried apricot. "You know what girls like Janice hate most?"
"What?"
"Being made a fool of." Jess remembered how Janice had looked the day he'd made everyone laugh at her on the bus. Leslie was right. There was a crack in the old hippo hide.
"Yeah," he nodded, beginning to smile. "Yeah.
Do we get her about being fat?"
"How about," Leslie began slowly, "how about boys? Who's she stuck on?"
"Willard Hughes, I reckon. Every girl in the 7th grade slides to the ground when he walks by."
"Yeah."
Leslie's eyes were shining. The plan came all in a rush. "We write her a note, you see, and pretend it's from Willard." Jess was already getting a pencil from the can and yanking a piece of notebook paper out from under a rock. He handed them to Leslie.
"No, you write. My handwriting's too good for Willard Hughes."
He got set and waited.
"Okay," she said.
"Dear Janice."
"No,
dearest Janice." Jess hesitated, doubtful.
"Believe me, Jess, she'll eat it up."
"Okay. Dearest Janice. Don't worry about punctuation or anything. We have to make it look as if Willard Hughes really wrote it."
"Okay.
Dearest Janice. Maybe you won't believe me, but I love you."
"You think she'll..."
he asked as he wrote it down.
"I told you, she'll eat it up. Girls like Janice Avery believe just what they want to in this kind of situation."
"Okay, now.
If you say you do not love me, it will break my heart. So please don't. If you love me as much as I love you, my darling... Hold it, I can't write that fast. Leslie waited. When he looked up, she continued in a moony voice. Meet me behind the school this afternoon, after school. Do not worry about missing your bus. I want to walk home with you and talk about us. Put us in capitals. My darling, love and kisses, Willard Hughes.
Kisses?
Yeah, kisses. Put a little row of X's in there, too. She paused, looking over his shoulder while he finished. Oh, yes. Put P.S. He did. Don't tell nobody. Let our love be a secret for only us two right now. Why'd you put that in? So she'll be sure to tell somebody, stupid. Leslie reread the note, nodding approval. Good. You misspelled believe and two. She studied it a minute longer.
Gee, I'm pretty good at this.
Sure, you probably had some big secret love down in Arlington. Jess Ahrens, I'm going to kill you. Hey, girl, you kill the King of Terabithia and you're in trouble.
Regicide, she said proudly.
Regi what? Did I ever tell you the story of Hamlet? He rolled over on his back.
Not yet, he said happily.
Lord, he loved Leslie's stories. Someday, when he was good enough, he would ask her to write them in a book and let him do all the pictures. Well, she began, there was once a prince of Denmark named Hamlet. In his head, he drew the shadowy castle with a tortured prince pacing the parapets. How could you make a ghost come out of the fog? Crayons wouldn't do, of course, but with paints, you could put one thin color on top of another so that you would begin to see a pale figure moving from deep inside the paper. He began to shiver. He knew he could do it if Leslie would let him use her paints. The hardest part of the plan to get Janice Avery was to plant the note. They sneaked into the building the next morning before the first bell. Leslie went several yards ahead so that if they were caught, no one would think they were together. Mr. Turner was deaf on boys and girls he caught sneaking around the halls together. She got to the door of the seventh grade classroom and peeked in. Then she signaled Jess to come ahead. The hairs prickled up his neck.
Lord,
how will I find her desk?
I thought you knew where she sat.
He shook his head.
I guess you'll have to look in every one until you find it. Hurry, I'll be lookout for you.
She closed the door quietly and left him shuffling through each desk, trying to be careful not to make a mess. But his stupid hands were shaking so much he could hardly pull anything out to look for names. Suddenly he heard Leslie's voice.
Oh, Mrs. Pierce! I've just been standing here waiting for you.
Lord, the seventh grade teacher was right out there in the hall, heading for this room. He stood frozen. He couldn't hear what Mrs. Pierce was saying back to Leslie through the closed door.
Yes, ma'am. There is a very interesting nest on the south end of the building. And since...
Leslie raised her voice even louder.
You know so much about science, I was hoping you could take a minute to look at it with me and tell me what built it.
There was the mumble of a reply.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Pierce.
Leslie was practically screaming.
It won't take but a minute, but it would mean so much to me.
As soon as he heard their retreating footsteps, he flew around the remaining desks until, oh, joy, he found one with a composition book that had Janice Avery's name on it. He stuffed the note on top of everything else inside the desk and raced out of the room to the boys' room, where he hid in one of the stalls until the bell rang to go to homeroom. At recess time, Janice Avery was in a tight huddle with Wilma and Bobby Sue. Then, instead of teasing the little girls, the three of them wandered off arm in arm to watch the big boys' football. As the trio passed them, Jess could see Janice's face all pink and prideful. He rolled his eyes at Leslie, and she rolled hers back at him. As the bus was about to pull out that afternoon, one of the seventh-grade boys, Billy Morris, yelled up to Mrs. Prentice that Janice Avery wasn't on the bus yet.
"It's okay, Miss Prentice,"
Wilma Dean called up.
"She ain't riding this evening."
Then, in a loud whisper, "Reckon y'all know that Janice has a heavy date with you-know-who."
"Who?"
asked Billy.
"Willard Hughes. He's so crazy about her he can't hardly stand it. He's even walking her all the way home."
Yeah, well, the 304 just pulled out with Willard Hughes on the back seat. If he's got a big date, he don't seem to know much about it.
You lie, Billy Morris.
Billy yelled a cuss word, and the entire back seat plunged into a heated discussion as to whether Janice Avery and Willard Hughes were or were not in love, and were or were not seeing each other secretly. As Billy got off the bus, he hollered to Wilma,
"You just better tell Janice that Willard's gonna be mad when he hears what she's spreading all over the school."
Wilma's face was crimson as she screamed out the window,
"Okay, you dummy! You talk to Willard, you'll see. Just ask him about that letter. You'll see."
"Poor old Janice Avery," Jess said as they sat in the castle later.
"Poor old Janice?
She deserves everything she gets, and then some." "I reckon," he sighed, "but still..." Leslie looked stricken.
"You're not sorry we did it, are you?"
"No, I reckon we had to do it, but still..."
"Still what?"
He grinned. "Maybe I got this thing for Janice like you got this thing for killer whales." She punched him in the shoulder. "Let's go out and find some giants or walking dead to fight. I'm sick of Janice Avery." The next day, Janice Avery stomped onto the bus, her eyes daring everyone in sight to say a word. Leslie nudged Maybelle. Maybelle's eyes went wide.
"Did you?"
"Shh. Yes." Maybelle turned completely around and stared at the back seat. Then she turned back and poked Jess.
"You made her that mad?"
Jess nodded, trying to move his head as little as possible as he did so.
"We wrote that letter," Leslie whispered. "But you mustn't tell anyone or she'll kill us."
"I know," said Maybelle, her eyes shining.
"I know."
Chapter 6. The Coming of Prince Tarion. Christmas was almost a month away, but at Jess's house the girls were already obsessed with it. This year, Ellie and Brenda both had boyfriends at the Consolidated High School, and the problem of what to give them and what to expect from them was cause of endless speculation and fights. Fights because, as usual, their mother was complaining that there was hardly enough money to give the little girls something from Santa Claus, let alone a surplus to buy record albums or shirts for a pair of boys she'd never set eyes on.
"What are you giving your girlfriend, Jess?"
Brenda screwed her face up in that ugly way she had. He tried to ignore her. He was reading one of Leslie's books, and the adventures of an assistant pig keeper were far more important to him than Brenda's sauce.
"Don't you know, Brenda?" Ellie joined in. "Jess ain't got no girlfriend."
"Well, you're right for once. Nobody with any sense would call that stick a girl."
Brenda pushed her face right into his and grinned the word girl through her big painted lips. Something huge and hot swelled right up inside of him, and if he hadn't jumped out of the chair and walked away, he would have smacked her. He tried to figure out later what had made him so angry. Partly, of course, it made him furious that anyone as dumb as Brenda would think she could make fun of Leslie. Lord, it hurt his guts to realize that it was Brenda who was his blood sister, and that really, from anyone else's point of view, he and Leslie were not related at all. "Maybe," he thought, "I was a foundling, like in the stories. Way back when the creek had water in it, I came floating down it in a wicker basket, waterproofed with pitch. My dad found me and brought me here because he'd always wanted a son and just had stupid daughters. My real parents and brothers and sisters live far away, farther away than West Virginia or even Ohio. Somewhere I have a family who have rooms filled with nothing but books and who still grieve for their baby who was stolen." He shook himself back to the source of his anger. He was angry, too, because it would soon be Christmas, and he had nothing to give Leslie. It was not that she would expect something expensive. It was that he needed to give her something, as much as he needed to eat when he was hungry. He thought about making her a book of his drawings. He even stole paper and crayons from school to do it with. But nothing he drew seemed good enough, and he would end up scrawling across the half-finished page and poking it into the stove to burn up. By the last week of school before the holiday, he was growing desperate. There was no one he could ask for help or advice. His dad had told him he would give him a dollar for each member of the family, but even if he cheated on the family presents, there was no way he could get from that enough to buy Leslie anything worth giving her. Besides, Maybelle had her heart set on a Barbie doll, and he had already promised to pool his money with Ellie and Brenda for that. Then the price had gone up, and he found he would have to go over into everyone else's dollar to make up the full amount for Maybelle.
Somehow, this year, Maybelle needed something special. She was always moping around. He and Leslie couldn't include her in their activities, but that was hard to explain to someone like Maybelle. Why didn't she play with Joyce Ann? He couldn't be expected to entertain her all the time. Still, she ought to have the Barbie. So there was no money, and he seemed paralyzed in his efforts to make anything for Leslie. She wouldn't be like Brenda or Ellie. She wouldn't laugh at him no matter what he gave her. But for his own sake, he had to give her something that he could be proud of. If he had the money, he'd buy her a TV, one of those tiny Japanese ones that she could keep in her own room without bothering Judy and Bill. It didn't seem fair, with all their money, that they'd gotten rid of the TV. It wasn't as if Leslie would watch the way Brenda did, with her mouth open and her eyes bulging like a goldfish, hour after hour. But every once in a while, a person liked to watch. At least if she had one, it would be one less thing for the kids at school to sneer about. But, of course, there was no way that he could buy her a TV. It was pretty stupid of him even to think about it. Lord, he was stupid. He gazed miserably out the window of the school bus. It was a wonder someone like Leslie would even give him the time of day. It was because there was no one else. If she had found anyone else at that dumb school... He was so stupid, he had almost gone straight past the sign without catching on. But something in a corner of his head clicked, and he jumped up, pushing past Leslie and Maybelle. "See you later," he mumbled, and shoved his way up the aisle through pair after pair of sprawling legs. "Let me off here, Miss Prentice, will you?" "This ain't your stop." "Gotta do an errand for my mother," he lied. "Long as you don't get me into trouble." She eased the brakes. "No'm. Thanks." He swung off the bus before it had really stopped and ran back toward the sign. Puppies, it said. Free. Jess told Leslie to meet him at the castle stronghold on Christmas Eve afternoon. The rest of his family had gone to the Millsburg Plaza for last-minute shopping, but he stayed behind. The dog was a little brown and black thing with great brown eyes. Jess stole a ribbon from Brenda's drawer and hurried across the field and down the hill with the puppy squirming in his arms. Before he got to the creek bed, it had licked his face raw and sent a stream down his jacket front, but he couldn't be mad. He tucked it tightly under his arm and swung across the creek as gently as he could. He could have walked through the gully, it would have been easier, but he couldn't escape the feeling that one must enter Terabithia only by the prescribed entrance. He couldn't let the puppy break the rules. It might mean bad luck for both of them. At the stronghold, he tied the ribbon around the puppy's neck, laughing as it backed out of the loop and chewed at the ends of the ribbon. It was a clever, lively little thing, a present Jess could be proud of. There was no mistaking the delight in Leslie's eyes. She dropped to her knees on the cold ground, picked the puppy up, and held it close to her face. "Watch it," Jess cautioned. "It sprays worse than a water pistol." Leslie moved it out a little way. "Is it male or female?" Once in a rare while, there was something he could teach Leslie. "Boy," he said happily. "Then we'll name him Prince Terrion, to make him the guardian of Terabithia." She put the puppy down and got to her feet. "Where are you going?" "To the Grove of the Pines," she answered. "This is a time of greatest joy." Later that afternoon, Leslie gave Jess his present. It was a box of watercolors with 24 tubes of color and 3 brushes and a pad of heavy art paper. "Lord," he said. "Thank you." He tried to think of a better way to say it, but he couldn't. "Thank you," he repeated. "It's not a great present like yours," she said humbly, "but I hope you'll like it." He wanted to tell her how proud and good she made him feel, that the rest of Christmas didn't matter because today had been so good, but the words he needed weren't there. "Oh, yeah. Yeah," he said, and then got up on his knees and began to bark at Prince Terrion. The puppy raced around him in circles, yelping with delight. Leslie began to laugh. It egged Jess on. Everything the dog did, he imitated, flopping down at last with his tongue lolling out. Leslie was laughing so hard she had trouble getting the words out. You're crazy. How will we teach him to be a noble guardian? You're turning him into a clown. Ruff! Wailed Prince Terrion, rolling his eyes skyward. Jess and Leslie both collapsed. They were in pain from the laughter. "Maybe," said Leslie at last, "we'd better make him court jester." "What about his name?"
Oh, we'll let him keep his name. Even a prince, this in her most Terabithian voice. Even a prince may be a fool. That night, the glow of the afternoon stayed with him. Even his sister's squabbling about when presents were to be opened did not touch him. He helped Maybelle wrap her wretched little gifts, and even sang Santa Claus is Coming to Town with her and Joyce Ann. Then Joyce Ann cried because they had no fireplace, and Santa wouldn't be able to find the way, and suddenly he felt sorry for her going to Millsburg Plaza, and seeing all those things, and hoping that some guy in a red suit would give her all her dreams. Maybelle at 6 was already too wise. She was just hoping for that stupid Barbie. He was glad he'd splurged on it. Joyce Ann wouldn't care that he only had a hair clip for her. She would blame Santa, not him, for being cheap. He put his arm awkwardly around Joyce Ann. Come on, Joyce Ann, don't cry. Old Santa knows the way. He don't need a chimney, does he, Maybelle? Maybelle was watching him with her big, solemn eyes. Jess gave her a knowing wink over Joyce Ann's head. It melted her. No, Joyce Ann, he knows the way. He knows everything. She squenched up her right cheek in a vain effort to return his wink. She was a good kid. He really liked old Maybelle. The next morning, he helped her dress and undress her Barbie at least 30 times. Slithering the skinny dress over the doll's head and arms and snapping the tiny fasteners was more than her chubby 6-year-old fingers could manage. He had received a racing car set, which he tried to run to please his father. It wasn't one of those big sets that they advertised on TV, but it was electric, and he knew his dad had put more money into it than he should have. But the silly cars kept falling off at the curves until his father was cursing at them with impatience. Jess wanted it to be okay. He wanted so much for his dad to be proud of his present, the way he, Jess, had been proud of the puppy. It's really great, really. I just ain't got the hang of it yet. His face was red, and he kept shoving his hair back out of his eyes as he leaned over the plastic figure-eight track. Cheap junk. His father kicked at the floor dangerously near the track. Don't get nothing for your money these days. Joyce Ann was lying on her bed screaming because she had yanked the string out of her talking doll and it was no longer talking. Brenda had her lips stuck out because Ellie had gotten a pair of pantyhose in her Christmas stocking and she had only bobby socks. Ellie wasn't helping matters, prancing around in her new hose, making a big show of helping Mama with the ham and sweet potatoes for dinner. Lord, sometimes Ellie was as snotty as Wanda K. Moore. Jesse Oliver Aarons, Jr., if you can stop playing with those fool cars long enough to milk the cow, I'd be most appreciative. Miss Bessie don't take no holiday, even if you do. Jess jumped up, pleased for an excuse to leave the track which he couldn't make work to his dad's satisfaction. His mother seemed not to notice the promptness of his response, but went on in a complaining voice. I don't know what I'd do without Ellie. She's the only one of you kids ever cares whether I live or die. Ellie smiled like a plastic angel, first at Jess, and then at Brenda, who glared back. Leslie must have been watching for him, because as soon as he started across the yard, he could see her running out of the old Perkins place, the puppy half-tripping her as it chased circles around her. They met at Miss Bessie's shed. I thought you'd never come out this morning. Yeah, well, Christmas, you know. Prince Terrian began to snap at Miss Bessie's hooves. She stamped in annoyance. Leslie picked him up so Jess could milk. The puppy squirmed and licked, making it almost impossible for her to talk. She giggled happily. Dumb dog, she said proudly. Yeah, it felt like Christmas again. Chapter 7, The Golden Room. Mr. Burke had begun to repair the old Perkins place. After Christmas, Mrs. Burke was right in the middle of writing a book, so she wasn't available to help, which left Leslie the jobs of hunting and fetching. For all his smartness with politics and music, Mr. Burke was inclined to be absent-minded. He might put down the hammer to pick up the how-to book, and then lose the hammer between there and the project he was working on. Leslie was good at finding things for him, and he liked her company as well. When she came home from school and on the weekends, he wanted her around. Leslie explained all this to Jess. Jess tried going to Terabithia alone, but it was no good. It needed Leslie to make the magic,
He was afraid he would destroy everything by trying to force the magic on his own, when it was plain that the magic was reluctant to come for him. If he went home, either his mother was after him to do some chore, or Maybelle wanted him to play Barbie. Lord, he wished a million times he'd never helped buy that stupid doll. He'd no more than lie down on the floor to paint than Maybelle would be after him to put an arm back on or snap up a dress. Joyce Anne was worse. She got a devilish delight out of sitting smack down on his rump when he was stretched out working. If he yelled at her to get the heck off him, she'd stick her index finger in the corner of her mouth and holler, which would, of course, crank up his mother.
"Jesse Oliver, you leave that baby alone! What you mean lying there in the middle of the floor doing nothing anyway? Didn't I tell you I couldn't cook supper before you chopped wood for the stove?"
Sometimes he would sneak down to the old Perkins place and find Prince Terrian crying on the porch, where Mr. Burke had exiled him. You couldn't blame the man. No one could get anything done with that animal grabbing his hand or jumping up to lick his face. He'd take P.T. for a romp in the Burke's upper field. If it was a mild day, Miss Bessie would be mooing nervously from across the fence. She couldn't seem to get used to the yipping and snapping. Or maybe it was the time of year, the last dregs of winter spoiling the taste of everything. Nobody, human or animal, seemed happy. Except Leslie. She was crazy about fixing up that broken-down old wreck of a house. She loved being needed by her father. Half the time they were supposed to be working, they were just yakking away. She was learning, she related glowingly at recess, to understand her father. It had never occurred to Jess that parents were meant to be understood any more than the safe at the Millsburg First National was sitting around begging him to crack it. Parents were what they were. It wasn't up to you to try to puzzle them out. There was something weird about a grown man wanting to be friends with his own child. He ought to have friends his own age and let her have hers. Jess's feelings about Leslie's father poked up like a canker sore. You keep biting it, and it gets bigger and worse instead of better. You spend a lot of time trying to keep your teeth away from it. Then, sure as Christmas, you forget the silly thing and chomp right down on it. Lord, that man got in his way. It even poisoned what time he did have with Leslie. She'd be sitting there bubbling away at recess, and it would be almost like the old times. Then, without warning, she'd say, "Bill thinks so-and-so." Chomp, right down on the old sore. Finally, she noticed. It took her until February, and for a girl as smart as Leslie, that was a long, long time. "Why don't you like Bill?"
"Who said I didn't?"
"Jess Ahrens. How stupid do you think I am?"
"Pretty stupid, sometimes."
But what he actually said was, "What makes you think I don't like him?"
"Well, you never come to the house anymore. At first I thought it was something I'd done, but it's not that. You still talk to me at school.
Lots of times I see you in the field, playing with P.T., but you don't even come near the door."
"You're always busy."
He was uncomfortably aware of how much he sounded like Brenda when he said this.
"Well, for spaghetti sauce, you could offer to help, you know."
It was like all the lights coming back on after an electrical storm. Lord, who was the stupid one? Still, it took him a few days to feel comfortable around Leslie's father. Part of the problem was he didn't know what to call him.
"Hey," he'd say, and both Leslie and her father would turn around.
Mr. Burke."
"I wish you'd call me Bill, Jess."
"Yeah." He fumbled around with the name for a couple more days, but it came more easily with practice. It also helped to know some things that Bill, for all his brains and books, didn't know. Jess found he was really useful to him, not a nuisance to be tolerated or set out on the porch like P.T.
"You're amazing," Bill would say. "Where did you learn that, Jess?"
Jess never quite knew how he knew things, so he'd shrug and let Bill and Leslie praise him to each other, though the work itself was praise enough. First, they ripped out the boards that covered the ancient fireplace, coming upon the rusty bricks like prospectors upon the mother lode. Next, they got the old wallpaper off the living room wall, all 5 garish layers of it. Sometimes as they lovingly patched and painted, they listened to Bill's records or sang, Leslie and Jess teaching Bill some of Miss Edmund's songs, and Bill teaching them some he knew. At other times, they would talk. Jess listened wonderingly as Bill explained things that were going on in the world. If Mama could hear him, she'd swear he was another Walter Cronkite instead of some hippie. All the Burkes were smart.
Not smart, maybe, about fixing things or growing things, but smart in a way Jess had never known real-life people to be. Like one day while they were working, Judy came down and read out loud to them, mostly poetry, and some of it in Italian, which of course Jess couldn't understand. But he buried his head in the rich sound of the words and let himself be wrapped warmly around in the feel of the Burke's brilliance. They painted the living room gold. Leslie and Jess had wanted blue, but Bill held out for gold, which turned out to be so beautiful that they were glad they had given in. The sun would slant in from the west in the late afternoon until the room was brimful of light. Finally, Bill rented a sander from Millsburg Plaza, and they took off the black floor paint down to the wide oak boards and refinished them. "No rugs," Bill said.
"No," agreed Judy. "It would be like putting a veil on the Mona Lisa."
When Bill and the children had finished razor-blading the last bits of paint off the windows and washed the panes, they called Judy down from her upstairs study to come and see. The four of them sat down on the floor and gazed around. It was gorgeous. Leslie gave a deep, satisfied sigh. "I love this room," she said. "Don't you feel the golden enchantment of it? It is worthy to be..." Jess looked up in sudden alarm. "In a palace." Relief. In such a mood, a person might even let a sworn secret slip. But she hadn't, not even to Bill and Judy, and he knew how she felt about her parents. She must have seen his anxiety because she winked at him across Bill and Judy just as he sometimes winked at Maybelle over Joyce Ann's head. Terabithia was still just for the two of them. The next afternoon, they called P.T. and headed for Terabithia. It had been more than a month since they had been there together, and as they neared the creek bed, they slowed down. Jess wasn't sure he still remembered how to be a king. "We've been away for many years," Leslie was whispering. "How do you suppose the kingdom has fared in our absence? Where have we been?" "Conquering the hostile savages on our northern borders," she answered. "But the lines of communication have been broken, and thus we do not have tidings of our beloved homeland for many a full moon." How was that for regular queen talk? Jess wished he could match it. "You think anything bad has happened?" "We must have courage, my king. It may indeed be so." They swung silently across the creek bed. On the farther bank, Leslie picked up two sticks. "Thy sword, sire," she whispered. Jess nodded. They hunched down and crept toward the stronghold like police detectives on TV.